We are really delighted that all of you are here tonight as we begin our series on Advent wreath and the meaning of each of the candles, and delighted that Bishop Jenny is here this evening. She is the first in the college, and they had a meeting earlier today wondering how it was going to go, and so the college will be waiting with bated breath at the close of tonight as Bishop Jenny checks in to say how it was at the cathedral. We are delighted that you are here. Bishop Jenny, as you know, was ordained bishop in 2016 and was the rector of St. Clement's before that, and also an associate at St. Paul's, but best known as a woman of deep faith and mission. If there was a mission to be had in the Diocese of Toronto, you know that Bishop Jenny has her hand on it somewhere, and we are delighted that you're here. And Bishop Jenny will speak for about 40 minutes and then have lots of opportunity for Q&A. Welcome.
Well, good evening. It really is wonderful to be here in Snell Hall with the cathedral community and some friends to be starting this Advent series. I'm under immense pressure at home from our three teenage daughters to put up the Christmas decorations. Right, our neighbors all around us on both sides have already put out their Christmas lights. It's not even Advent, I keep telling our daughters. Well, for your sake, Mummy, I sure hope Advent arrives soon, was what I heard at dinner last night. And so I think that because tonight I'm speaking about hope in Advent, when I get home, I can legitimately put out a few decorations, right? So thank you, Dean Asbill, for the invitation, and I'm really pleased to be dwelling with you on the theme of hope. As the dean said, there'll be some time for questions later, but I will also have some work for you to do in our time together to interact with one another at specific moments, so you've been warned. Advent, of course, is a season of waiting, of building anticipation, when we kind of try and strain our ears to hear the first sounds of new life that just might emerge from that manger. The Advent wreath, breaking open the darkness as winter draws in, allows us with each candle to focus our hearts on a particular longing that we might have, a longing that actually every human heart has. And tonight, we long for hope. And hope is something that we cannot generate on our own. Hope is something we cannot generate on our own. It needs to be based on something outside of ourselves. Dietrich Bonhoeffer vividly grasped this from a Nazi jail. "Life in a prison cell," wrote Bonhoeffer, "may well be compared to Advent. One waits, hopes, does this, does that, but the door is shut and can only be opened from the outside." Tonight, I want to dwell on the door that needs to be opened from the outside for hope to enter. And I believe, and I've experienced in my own life, that that door is actually the grace of God. How does the grace of God lead to more hope-filled lives? What's the connection in Advent between grace and Advent hope? So let's start with grace, and then we'll move on to hope. Grace, the word's everywhere. You probably said a grace before dinner tonight. We're grateful for someone's kindness. We leave a gratuity if we're pleased at a restaurant. And a composer may add grace notes to her score. All these hint at its meaning. Grace is something free, something extra, something life-giving. And we can also see it from the opposite. Do you remember how Mayor Ford fell from grace? We insult a person by calling them an ingrate, their lack of grace, a persona non grata. You are not welcome here, a person without grace. But of course, the scriptures use the word in a specific way, to refer to God's unmerited favor, a door that has to be opened from the outside. Grace is God's new life and purpose given to people who thankfully have not had to earn it. And we have mighty Augustine to thank for this. Augustine was the first Western theologian to develop this doctrine of grace. Grace taken not in the sense of being a divine attribute, God as a gracious God, which is true, but Augustine wanted to understand grace in the sense of the benefits that the church receives through the person and work of Jesus Christ. Grace as a benefit, not simply as an attribute of God. All the benefits of his passion, as the prayer book puts it. Or another way to grasp Augustine's doctrine of grace is love with truth. Love without truth, as I'm sure you know, is just sentimentality, either about a situation or a particular person. It may affirm our view in something or someone, but frankly, it keeps us in intellectual denial about flaws or problems. And remember that Augustine's teacher was Ambrose of Milan, who arguably had the best grasp on understanding original sin at that time in the church. There was no sentimentality in Ambrose. The fact that we desperately need God's grace is love with truth, the truth about ourselves, that I need the grace of God. Now, if we have truth, but of course no love, that's simply harshness, you know, the opposite of sentimentality. And truth without love may give us information, may give us facts about our nature, for example, but it gives it to us in a way that we simply can't hear it, even if we've recited the general confession 1,000 times, for it to have any positive impact on us. But God's grace is different because it's shown to us in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And it's marked on the one hand by this kind of shocking truthfulness about who we really are. Right? I always say Christians are the ultimate intellectual realists. We're unwilling to put our heads in the sand. So it's marked by this kind of shocking realism on the one hand, that moves us beyond superficiality, and on the other hand, radical, unconditional commitment to us, always, an authentic love. Writer Gordon MacDonald said it like this: "The world can do almost anything as well as or better than the church. You need not to be Christians to build houses, feed the hungry, heal the sick. There's only one thing the world cannot do. It cannot offer grace." Now, I think it all sounds great, but sadly, our human default is to what I call ungrace, you know, the exact opposite, to give people what they deserve. Make people experience the full consequences of their actions. You made the bed, you've got to lie in it. Right? We have 3 teenagers. This is like my MO these days, right? Our economic and legal institutions primarily function on ungrace. Imagine a brokerage firm or an airline basing its business model on grace, giving people what they don't deserve. They'd be bankrupt within the year. And a person whose life is based on ungrace will have keeping up appearances as a key characteristic. Because remember, they emphasize love without truth. So there will be a lack of honesty about failings or even sufferings. How are you? Just great. Just great. Right? There'll be a superficiality because they value keeping up appearances. And there'll be an incredible pressure to keep up the facade. Literally, clothes, material possessions, parish statistics, but also emotionally, right? How are you? Great, great, works terrific, best bonus yet this year. Kids are doing so well in school, marriage, never been better, right? There can be a superficiality and a real fear that you're not known. Or if the person of ungrace emphasizes truth but little love, then they are constantly criticizing and they're a gossip, needing to find fault as their way of shoring up their own self-worth, right? Their own image. And clergy are particularly bad at this. All arguments need to be won, and those who think differently must be mistaken, potentially ridiculed, and eventually excluded. And when ungrace has gripped someone's heart, they live lives defined by worry or fear, because ungrace fundamentally tells us of needing to earn God's love and earn God's acceptance. So you're constantly worried about what the future holds, unsure of whether God will really provide for your deepest longings. Grace and ungrace. We're going to connect it to hope in just a minute. And I'm going to put you to work right now. And I'm going to ask you to turn to your neighbor. Hopefully there's enough people at your table to turn into pairs. And share, as you feel comfortable, where you've experienced grace or ungrace in the life of the church. Grace or ungrace in the life of the church. Just take a few minutes, pick one, pick grace or pick ungrace, and just share. I'm hoping there have been more grace-filled stories than stories filled with ungrace, although life usually has them in equal measure. So if grace, love with truth, is God's radical, unconditional commitment to us in Christ Jesus, a commitment that can free us from the fear and anxiety that dogs a heart marked by ungrace, what's the connection of grace to hope? Have you ever really wanted someone or really wanted something? I bet you have. Do you remember how you felt when they were finally in your arms or you owned it? So good. But the feeling didn't last. We've all experienced this to one degree or another, and it's just part of being human. Very early on in life, we equate pleasure with happiness, and so we search. We feel satisfied, we enjoy it for a time, but then the void returns. And we either move on to seeking a new pleasure, a new person, another vacation, a new outfit, or we try and recreate the original source of pleasure, right? Rekindle the romance, have another child. But the cycle continues, repeating itself throughout our lives, and we can often never experience real happiness. There's an academic publication called The Journal of Happiness, like seriously. And a few years ago, Professor Ruud van Hoven of the Erasmus University in Rotterdam published an article called The Paradox of Hedonism. Hedonism is a way of life, he wrote, characterized by the desire for pleasurable experiences. Yep, so far so good. But then he says this: there are many qualms about hedonism. It can be rejected on moral grounds and said to be detrimental to long-term happiness. And several mechanisms for this paradox of hedonism will be examined in this academic paper, and consistent examples of pleasure seekers ending up in despair will be presented. Holy cow! Despair? And I'm talking about hedonism not because I particularly think that's the pastoral problem afflicting the parishioners of St. James Cathedral is hedonism, but because I do think we can get trapped into searching for happiness or pleasure, something that we decide to seek, a door that we try to open ourselves, with failure inevitably in the cards, rather than hope, a door that gets open to us from the outside, a hope-filled life that can be opened up through experiencing the grace of God. And I want to be really clear so there's no misunderstanding. Many of the good things that we seek in life for pleasure and happiness, of course, are gifts from God, wine being the most obvious, right? But there's also the beauty of math, the wonder of music, friends, sports, the list goes on. So why the paradox? Why the potential for despair? Why the vicious cycle of craving, pursuit, consumption, and then emptiness? St. Paul personally experienced what we so deeply want, Philippians 4, verse 11. Not that I am referring to being in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever I have. I know what it is to have little, and I know what it is to have plenty. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being well fed and of going hungry, of having plenty, and of being in need. Where do you get that kind of hopeful equilibrium? What's the secret that he's referring to? What does Paul know that we don't know, or at least I don't know, in my daily life, that I will admit is not always marked by hope-filled equilibrium? Well, if you read the scriptures for any length of time, you will see that there seem to be two basic ways that people search for happiness in life, when they try to open the door themselves, right? As opposed to hope, where the door gets opened for you. And both of these attempts to open the door yourself will eventually fail. And this is roughly how they go. And this is incredibly broad brushstrokes, right? And one is the life of sort of moral compliance, right? And the other is a life of pleasure seeking and self-discovery, you know, hedonism. And moral compliance goes something like this, right? If I obey these rules, I'm generally a nice person, I pay my taxes, God will love me and my life will go well. Like my parents grew up going to British boarding schools. This is what they were taught was life, and it was also equated with the Christian faith, right? Fatal mistake, but anyway, I digress. There are, of course, variations on this theme, but they all believe in putting the standards of the community ahead of any personal desire, right? Duty. And we will, of course, fail at times, but then when we do fail, we are judged by how abject and groveling our regret is. It's actually still moral compliance. Are you groveling enough? Still, there's still a community standard that you have to meet. And in the moral compliance view, it functions through guilt and shame, right? And even in our failures, we have to measure up. So that's one basic path in life, right? And different cultures will lean into that path. The other strategy to find happiness, not yet at hope, that Paul talks about, of course, is pleasure-seeking and self-discovery. And this strategy holds out that people like you and I, we have to be free to pursue our goals regardless of community standards, regardless of tradition. And the world would be a better place if all barriers to personal freedom and choice were removed. It was like she must have been six at the time, our middle daughter, Kate, I was disciplining her for something, and she's like, you know what, Mommy, you're not the boss of me. I was like, kiddo, I so am the boss of you for like 12 more years, right? But she believed the world would be a better place if all barriers to her personal freedom and choice were removed. And you see this in the life of the church too, right? No barrier to personal freedom and choice.